we're fighting for our imaginations, for the right to be free, for the right to think, for the right to love each other, for the right to imagine a better world. And poems preserve that space. They remind us why.
Coming up on In Contrast, White Poetry with Matthew Zapruder. I'm Ilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Matthew Zapruder is a poet, editor, and translator. His collection, The Pajamist, won the 2007 William Carlos Williams Award from the Poetry Society of America. His most recent book is Why Poetry, an impassioned call to return to reading poetry in an argument for poetry's accessibility. Matthew Zapruder, thank you for coming to In Contrast today. I'm delighted. I want to start our discussion of poetry, what it does, how it does it, the connection that it has or doesn't with people of all ages, with a couple of lines from a poem by Marianne Moore. It is a famous series of lines. The poem is simply called Poetry. It was first published in her first collection of poetry in 1921, and it goes like this. I, too, dislike it. There are things that are important beyond all this fiddle. Reading it, however, with a perfect contempt for it, one discovered in it, after all, a place for the genuine. It seems that even poets dislike poetry and are ambivalent about it. You are a poet, and you have written an extraordinary book about the role of poetry in society. You dislike poetry, or at least were disinterested in it. How did you come to become an advocate for poetry in these troubled times?
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to talk with you. Well, growing up, and I talk about this in the book, I just didn't think very much about poetry. And if I did think about it, I just associated it with school and assignments and obligations. I think like so many, quote unquote, normal students, I just didn't think of it as a thing that went beyond something like math or some other thing I had to do. I was much more interested in other things, sports, music, girls, the usual stuff. It didn't even really enter my mind. And it wasn't so much that I was suspicious of it. I just think it wasn't part of my consciousness. But what happened is that as I kind of brushed up against it a few times, both as a kid and then later in my college life, I took a few poetry classes at Amherst College where I had wonderful teachers. So I started to get a feeling of attraction to it that I almost didn't notice at first. And then in my early 20s, when I was studying Russian literature at UC Berkeley, I was getting a PhD in Slavic languages and literatures, I started writing poetry. It was a great surprise to me. So I think the poem snuck up on me in a way. And then my life, in a sense, since then has been an accounting for that strange fact of my attraction to this work and pleasure. And as far as what you said, I think you're right. I think so many poets have a, I don't want to say dislike, but a, you know, a suspicion or kind of like half an eye on poetry because of the way it's sentimentalized and talked about so foolishly so much in the culture. And it's raised to this exalted level that's impossible to really sustain with a poem. A poem is a wonderful thing, but it isn't, you know, going to save the world. So I think there's a way that Moore in those lines is reacting to that too. You know, she's trying to bring it back down to the basics. And then if you start by letting go of all the kind of mysticism and lacy, flowery language around poetry, you'll really start to feel its power. And that was a big part of what I wanted to do in the book, is to bring it back down to earth.
What do you think Marianne Moore refers to when she talks about all this fiddle?
I love that word fiddle because it's a kind of pun in a way, because of course she means fiddle, like it is an expression of fiddle faddle or like nonsense or whatever. But of course, literally fiddle, poets play the lyre, they're singers, you know, they're metaphorical sense musicians. And so all this fiddle, it's very characteristic of Moore. It's very attentive to the particular word. She didn't say all this nonsense. She didn't say all this foolishness. She said all this fiddle. And it carries with it both the dismissal of it and also the respect for it. Because a fiddle, after all, is a violin, which after all, you know, has made some of the most beautiful sounds humans ever heard. So it's always there, the contradiction. And that's what's so exciting for me about making and reading poetry.
throughout her life, and I'm staying here with Marianne Moore, she seemed to be wrestling with this poem. It had many more stanzas, and then she shortened it as life went on, up to the point where almost this few lines were what remained. One gets the sense that she was born to write these lines. She realized she could decorate them with all sorts of other important statements, but in the end, the epicenter of what she was all about were these words organized in this particular way. And in these sentences, it seems to me that the word genuine is at the very end, and she doesn't use the word exactly like that. What do you think she means by the end of that sentence?
Well, you know, it's, as you well know, that too is a paradox. All art is a made thing. It has an element of the constructed, of falseness, of artifice to it, right? So to say art is genuine is a paradox, but it also isn't, because the art that we love feels genuine to us. And I think that word means different things to different people. But authentic, truthful, connected with the center of life, that's sort of how I feel it, not decorated. Decoration is wonderful too. I mean, I don't know why the Alhambra popped into my mind. As a poet, I think I've always been suspicious of decoration. And I remember the first time I went to Spain and saw the Alhambra, like, it's all decoration. And it's like, thank goodness for decoration.
Right.
You know, and I remember having a very different reaction. It's funny because, as you said, she started with this kind of longish poem. It's many stanzas and she says many things. And then over time, she cut it. And then in her final version of her own selected poems that she herself put together, it's just those lines that you said.
Right.
But then in the notes, it's the whole poem. So she kind of goes back to including both things. And in writing about that poem in this book, there's that marvelous definition of poetry that she has, you know, imaginary gardens with real toads in them. Thank God she wrote that, because it's such a great thing to say about art. But it wasn't in the official final version of the poem, but it got preserved.
What are the ways that poets have with words that other writers do not? In what way would you say you as a poet, other poets, relate to language or to these bricks that are part of that language and shape them that others do not? Or am I here pushing an aspect of poetry that might be dangerous, isolating poets and seeing them as having a particular bridge in or a channel?
I don't think poets are necessarily better or have a more facility with language than other types of writers, not in my experience. I met a lot of wonderful writers who I'm quite sure are just as good writers as poets. It's more that poets are dangerously close to fetishizing the material of language itself. I'm always a little hesitant to start generalizing about other types of writing because I don't do it. I'm not a novelist. I'm not a short story writer.
But you are an essayist.
Kind of. I guess by accident I am. But I know that those writers are balancing a lot of different considerations as they write. You know, a novelist will immediately, when writing a novel, there's setting, there's character, there's all kinds of things that are balanced, and those things need to be factored in with the use of language. But a poet doesn't have to worry about those things. A poet can just allow the pleasure of language to direct the movement of the piece of writing. And that's a kind of great liberation, but it's also a dangerous one because it can quickly lead to the piece of writing not feeling very connected with life or with things that matter.
How does a poem come about with you? When is a thought or an emotion or an impression or an anecdote in your mind or in your heart or in your being move in such a way as to propel you to turn it into a text that is going to be stamped on the page?
Well, another popular misconception about poets is that they're somehow more sensitive to life. Or in my experience, it's maybe been the opposite. Sometimes they're a little less, a little more callous. But, you know, I'm living life like you are, like everybody listening is. And, you know, I'm going through collecting experiences, seeing things, having wonderful conversations, disappointments, inchoate fears, all the things, you know, anger, all that stuff. And it's all getting stored up in my brain. And then what happens is when I want to write the poem, and what I try to do is come to the page or the screen or in the notebook, whatever it is, as emptily as possible. And I just am looking for the words or the phrase that almost has a kind of texture to it, something that seems to have some life. Or sometimes I'll say maybe like a little electricity, like a little spark. and I just want to write a few words down, and you try, and there's nothing there, or it sounds silly, or not interesting. And then suddenly you write a few words, and it's like maybe an image, or maybe it's not even an image. Maybe it's just a couple of words, and you're like, oh, there's something there. And then try to add more and more. And then if it's working, if the poem starts to come to be, then all those things that I've been storing up, all those experiences, feelings, thoughts, whatever, anecdotes, pictures in my mind or whatever, will start to pour into the main thing. I think it's important to go without an agenda. For me, that's my process. I mean, some people have a different process. And I know that if I follow the music, I'm being metaphorical there, if I follow my interest in language, the poem will ultimately be about things that really matter to me and they're vital to my survival, but it'll happen in a way that was organic, that it wasn't planned.
I think you used the word emptily at some point. Emptily.
Is that a word? I think it's a word, right? Emptily? I don't know. Maybe I made it up.
Maybe, but it's a beautiful word. And I wonder if you can walk around it or into it, meaning without any preconceptions, empty of strategies that your mind has worked, paralyzing certain aspects of yourself. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I would maybe even make an analogy to athletics in a certain sense. I mean, you prepare, you train, you work out, you practice a million times, but you don't know the exact situation that's going to face you, you know, on the basketball court or the football field or soccer field, whatever. But you'll be able to deal with the variables as they come up and interact with them if you've been training. I come without a plan or agenda, but I come with all my training and all my practice.
And so, when is the poem finished? Is it finished?
I think that it is finished when you get to a point where changing it would be doing a violence to your core self. You can always tinker with a piece of writing. You know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But there comes a time, and I'm sure you must know what I mean, when you could change it, but it's something deeper that you'd be messing with.
However, there's always the present tense of the writer, in this case, the poet. So you don't want to tinker with that text because you feel it is rounded or whole or complete, but a day later or a month later or a year later, you go back to it and you feel it's finished, it's published, but I'm so distant from it.
Yeah.
And you might want to tinker with it.
Well, I'm a big believer in letting things be for a little while because you can sometimes think something is done and it isn't, for sure. I've had that experience. And I've even come back to things that have been published and later felt the need to change it. But also, I think a lot of the time you just grow past the poem. So I look at the poem and I think, I wouldn't do it that way again, or that's not me now. But that doesn't mean I don't like it or it doesn't feel authentic to me. My first book I wrote many years ago, and I go back occasionally to those poems. It's like a completely different person wrote those poems. But it doesn't mean that I don't like them or want to change them. I just think it's almost like looking at very old photographs of yourself. And so that's okay. I'm a big reviser. I'll blow everything up a million times. I'll write the poem and then go back to the next day and just explode it. I'll take all the lines out and put them in a different order and change everything because I'm searching for that feeling of that gear clicking into the other gear. And it's a mysterious thing as a writer.
There's the famous model of Walt Whitman himself, probably the man who was at the heart of what American poetry is all about, who spent his entire life revising Leaves of Grass.
Yeah.
And it was only death that one would say stopped him from going on.
Oh, for sure. And the amazing thing about Whitman is that I've read many biographies of Whitman. There is a mystery because he was a kind of, as you know, I don't want to say hack journalist. I mean, maybe that's a little unfair, but I mean, he was a kind of penny journalist and he wrote sort of genre stories. And then something happens and it is not really clear for a year or two. And somehow he takes all his big desires to be a famous writer and to change the world and help democracy and reform human beings and finds this form of Song of Myself. And there's no way to explain it. I mean, I've read so many biographies and there's a point where it just happens. And I think he probably stumbled on it, figured out those long lines, that kind of way of writing. It was a great fortune.
I find it fascinating that your book, White Poetry, and you have this intent on the mystifying poetry, but not of taking the mystery out of it. You were just talking about Whitman and the mystery of how he came to write Leaves of Grass, because the mystery is what propels the poet, but the kind of decoration that comes with poetry in our society, a society that emphasizes profit and emphasizes the self and emphasizes success, might see all these endeavors as marginal. I don't know if it's the right word to describe your book, but I'd like to get a reaction from you. In reading it and in being provoked by it and inspired by it, I kept on thinking this is a defense of poetry, mm-hmm. a defense of poetry in democracy, a defense of poetry in our troubled times. And then I kept on telling myself, if poetry needs to be defended, then we are already at a disadvantage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought about many subtitles for the book, and for sure defense. I mean, of course, a defense of poetry is a famous title that's been used. But it doesn't really feel like a defense to me. I thought maybe about calling it something like an autobiographical polemic or something, you know, because it's this mixed genre thing where there's a lot of personal story in it, but also a lot of close reading and then a lot of trying to put forth a reason why this activity matters. But I don't really actually think poetry needs me to come defend it. I think it will be fine without me. But I wanted to try to talk to people and with people based on a lot of interactions I had. I mean, I talk about that in the introduction about how really the motivation for writing the book was I just had so many conversations with really smart, interesting, educated, thoughtful, sensitive people who just expressed a total bewilderment when it came to poetry that they wouldn't say about modern art or jazz or looking up at the sky. So, and I thought, well, why is that? Why do people feel that way about this thing? And it interested me, mm-hmm. both as a poet, but also just kind of as a, I don't know, maybe a person who just likes figuring things out. There's that part too, you know, and that's a part of me that I get to indulge a little bit less in my poems. So maybe there was just a part of me that liked the idea of, wow, what would it be like to write a whole book about something?
In this disdain or this distancing or this maybe even ghettoizing of poetry, is it a modern phenomenon? I'm thinking now, throwing myself back into previous stages, the Enlightenment, the Renaissance, the Middle Ages, or classical times. It seems to me that what keeps poetry alive is that it's always under siege, that it's always in the margins, and that yet poets and those that defend or push poetry forward imagine a world in which poetry played a larger role. But almost by definition, it stays in the margins because that might be the place for poetry.
Right, maybe it is. And one of the reasons why I didn't want to think of this as a defense of poetry, because I don't want to just talk about only American poetry, only English language poetry. And in other cultures, poetry has a very different relationship to readership. And I mean, you have a book by Paz there. I mean, he's a completely different figure in relation to his culture and his society than American poets are. And so I was more interested in that aspect of poetry being kind of like scorned, sort of as being not profitable, both figuratively and literally, is a particularly American phenomenon, actually. That's not how people talk about it in Russia. But there is a deeper point that you're making that I totally agree with, which is that somehow poets put themselves in opposition to the main current of thinking. They're always doing that. There's a kind of desire to always see the other side or undercut things or turn it around and look at it in a different way. And I think that is true whether you're looking at 9th century Tang Dynasty poetry or Mexican poetry of the 20th century or Russian poetry, you know, everything. There's always that impulse, that impish, or what Lorca calls the duende, a desire to like come in and disrupt everything and remind everybody that we're all going to die and it's going to be fun.
You were talking about the book that I have in front of me. It is by Octavio Paz, the Mexican Nobel Prize winner, poet and essayist and biographer, The Monkey Grammarian. I just happened to have it in front of me. It is true that in Mexico, throughout Latin America, in Russia or the Soviet Union, the role that poets had, the role that poets assumed, I'm thinking here of Akhmatova or Josip Brodsky, or in Latin America, aside from Octavio Paz, Pablo Neruda, was the position of confronting the power, because in those landscapes, there is a vast segment of the population that is voiceless, and the poets assume the responsibility of speaking for the voiceless and of being courageous when others are not. You did it in passing by saying that in America, the role of poets is different. Is it that here poets don't need to take that position, or maybe depending on who is in power, they take that position? Is it here that poetry is more entertainment or more academic? One of the things that I want to ask you about, and you talk very eloquently in the book, on the one hand, the wonderful fact that poems are read in classrooms, because otherwise they would not be read by a younger generation. At the same time, the distressing fact that if it's only that they are read in the classroom, then is poetry for assignment and not for general engagement. But first, about the difference between an American poet and poets in societies that are probably more radicalized or, you know, one could go in a number of directions, economically uneven, although the United States is quite uneven.
Sure is. I am always a little reluctant to get into this area only because I'm not really like a sociologist or historian of literature. I'm a poet and I know poetry, but when it comes to these larger trends, I mean, I have my own observations and my own experiences having spent time in Russia and also in certain parts of Central Europe and seeing the different ways that poets are thought of. My suspicion, and I mean, I would actually love to hear what you think about this, is my suspicion is that it has to do with language. In a place, for instance, a place I've spent a lot of time is Slovenia, the former Yugoslavia, which is a country where poets are venerated. In their main square in Slovenia, in the city of Ljubljana, there's a statue of Prešeren, who's like kind of like this, you know, poet figure. A huge part of it is, I think, because they're a small country. And what makes them different from the places that surround them is their language. Their language is so central to their national identity. And America is a different kind of place. That's actually not true. It's a place where people come with their language and then they negotiate that old language in this new language of English. So I don't know. And most poets, and more this is true now, but most poets, either their parents or their grandparents, grew up with a different language and they came from a different place. So the whole idea of what it means to be American is more governmental in a way, or kind of has to do with societal agreement. So the relationship of the poet to that seems fundamentally different than a Russian poet and everybody speaks the language of Russian or Slovenians. But that's more of an anecdotal or personal like idea. But like I said, I'm not a historian of culture and I'm advancing this theory with great trepidation.
There's also the fact that in many of these countries, I'm thinking here of the Czech Republic or Russia or Croatia or Chile or Argentina, Peru, poets have also been tempted or allured to run for office.
Yeah, right.
That frequently has been a disaster. But there is the connection between poetry and politics that drives people to the edge because they feel that the poem, and this is where I wanted to get, can do something. Mm-hmm. This comes in reaction to the famous line by W.H. Auden that a poem does nothing. I can think of a famous poem by Pablo Neruda, I explain a few things, that is written in the middle of the Spanish Civil War, that is reacting to the fascist forces taking over Madrid. His own house is being brought down, the house where he met García Lorca and Machado and others. And one wonders, in reading and rereading that poem, why doesn't he just go and take a weapon and start fighting the way all these other Republicans were fighting for the return of equality and justice and democracy? But instead, he uses a poem that will do nothing immediately. And yet, it is the poem that has survived, one of the several that has survived that period. So I guess in some of those countries, one has the impression that poetry does do something and that Auden was wrong.
Yeah, I talk in the book about that line, you know, poetry makes nothing happen, in its elegy for Yeats. And I sort of try to make the point that in a sneaky way, that's a kind of assertion of, it sounds like he's saying poetry doesn't do anything, but in a way he's saying poetry makes nothing happen. It activates nothingness. It makes nothing start to happen. It makes what's absent or absence feel alive or start to be full of possibility or power or something. You know, I mean, thank God Neruda didn't pick up a weapon. He could have ended up like Lorca. I mean, not that Lorca chose to be in that situation, but we lost a lot of great poems from Lorca. But yeah, I don't know if I think poetry can help in these troubled times. What my idea that I come back again and again to in this book is, what are we struggling for? What are we fighting for? We're fighting to stay alive, not just in our bodies. Of course, we need that. And we're not just fighting to put food in our mouths, but we're fighting for our imaginations, for the right to be free, for the right to think, for the right to love each other, for the right to imagine a better world. And poems preserve that space. They remind us why, in a certain sense, we're doing all this stuff. Mm. I mean, of course, you know that we do it for our children and for our families and stuff, but they preserve just a kind of feeling of life, even in the darkest times. I think that explains why Neruda would have written that poem, or Tsvetaeva wrote the poem she did, or Akhmatova. You know, it wasn't because they thought writing those poems would make the war stop or make Stalin stop imprisoning people. It was because they were trying to make a place where things could survive.
I was hooked by that reference that you made to the fact that in dying so young, we lost a lot of poems that García Lorca could have written. And what popped into my mind is that the poems that we do have, the extraordinarily vast, maybe infinite selection of poems that are available, is the result of a kind of Darwinian process, individual as well as societal. In not encouraging the love of poetry, we might be losing extraordinary voices that never were able to find that mysterious moment that you found in school. And on the other hand, I think that if what you propose in your book, that is that we really create an environment where poetry is broadly embraced in a utopian vision, that could be a disaster too. If everybody loved poetry, then poetry would cease to be what it is.
It would find a way to be unlovable. There's always a contradiction at the heart. When you write a big book, when you write a sustained argument, you kind of come up against these contradictions. And it's like, on the one hand, I adore poetry, and on the other hand, I think very little of it. And I'm like Marianne Moore, and on the one hand, I would like everybody to read poetry. And on the other hand, I agree that there's something great about the fact that it's in the margins, and I don't need to march around forcing everyone to read poems. I said I wrote this book out of a desire to talk with the people who have a resistance to poetry, but there's also another part of me that when someone says, you know, I don't really get poetry, I say, fine, then don't read it. You know, I'm not the mayor of poetry, but, you know, I said I was more of an intellectual kind of project for me to see if I could answer questions. But I agree 1,000% with what you're saying. I think it's so funny that there's some people who say, oh, you know, what are we doing wrong? Why isn't poetry as popular as pop music? Of course, it's not as popular as pop music or blockbuster movies. And nor should it be. It doesn't have to be. I just don't want people who might otherwise like it to hate it because they got bad schooling. If you're a person who goes when the Picasso exhibit comes to your museum and you go and you love it and you go and you have some cool jazz records and you like Mozart and you like foreign movies or maybe even not foreign movies, regular movies that are just kind of interesting, there's no reason you shouldn't like some poems too.
Right.
Why are poems the one type of activity that gets exiled from this otherwise kind of mildly intellectual life, you know?
There's another contradiction too, and you will excuse me, but that's my role to present this extreme situations. And the contradiction is that the book in which you bring poetry to the fore is the one that people are reading and debating, and it is harder to present one's own poetry. In other words, it is your essay, your long essay, your beautiful essay that is pushing people to think of this, not poetry.
Believe me, this occurred to me. And that's why I felt it was important in the book to sneak in a lot of poetry. I mean, there's not my own poetry, which is fine. But I think if you read the book, you'll end up reading a lot of poetry and by sort of accident in a way. But then the other thing is that when I get to the end of the book, the last full chapter of the book, there's also an afterword that I wrote, but really is about how there's only so much explaining you can do about this subject. And that is inherent in the very act itself. I don't remember if I actually include this in the book, but there was a part where I wrote, most teachers of poetry get to a certain point where they start just reading poems and then just sort of shrugging their shoulders afterwards and then reading another one. There's nothing to say in some ways. And of course, there is so much to say, but there's a part of everybody who loves poetry or teaches poetry or is a poet who wants to just let it be there its own. And so I did have a lot of mixed feelings about that, and many times thought, oh, is this a mistake? Like, I don't want to overwrite this thing or write
it out of
existence.
It doesn't feel like a mistake, and it feels like an extraordinarily fertile way to consider the various sides that poetry has, including the very aspect of poetry in the classroom. I have been on a number of occasions, and myself have engaged in something, like you say, you let the poem speak for itself. You have a captive audience. It's younger. The only one who ages in the classroom is you. Everybody's always the same age. And you hope that something in a word or in a sentence or in a twist will live, probably not in the present, but 20 years from now when somebody will go back to that poem or hear again a sentence or that twist and will be transformed. I love teaching. I love having younger people in the class I struggle with the fact that poetry lives happily in the classroom, but sometimes only in the classroom. This is what we were talking about before. And that because of the economic labor circumstances of our own country, many poets and translators have to make a living teaching. Writers too. And the result is a minimalist, self-conscious, bookish type of poetry that can be very much about the history of this tradition or that one. But it's not about some of the things that you and I were talking about, the dirty, difficult, challenging imprisonment that can come from having to live as a poet in some other countries, or in this country as well, sometimes as a slam poet or a poet that will not surrender to the academic world. I use here the word surrender, having really benefited enormously for 25 years. I'm kind of biting or spitting on the hand that feeds me. But there is an ambivalence, because if it's only for the classroom, is it good for poetry?
No, it's not good for poetry. And I think that we've seen in the past time a big change in that area. The poet who is by far the best-selling poet, I'm quite sure, is Rupi Kaur, who is a poet who publishes her work on Instagram. And she has two books now. I know one is called Milk and Honey. I'm not sure what the other one is. She sold millions of copies of this book. She sold more copies of that book than if you took all the American poets and added them up. There are people watching poems on YouTube. And you mentioned slam poetry. That's in a way a different kind of thing, related, but not exactly the same thing. And it's a time of great change in these areas. I think a lot of people, thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of people, are reading poetry not in the classroom. Do I feel that that poetry is the best that poetry can do? No, I do not. But I feel like it is a signal, a sign that people need something else, and they're getting it, or at least starting to get it from those poems. And that's interesting for poets to start thinking about. And I know a lot of poets have begun to think about that. I think another thing that is happening, and which is really important to me and many other poets who teach, is to make sure that the voices that we're hearing from young poets are not just rich kids, to make room in the classrooms. And, you know, that's an unimpeachable goal, right? But what does that really mean? That means that we've had to really think about how we structure the classroom, and really think about how we structure what we teach and how we teach. And that's been a big change too, and it's exciting. And I think you're starting to see the results, because in American poetry right now, you've seen, I was just with two poets, Ricky Laurentis and Sophia Sinclair, African-American poets. Actually, Sophia's from Jamaica. And these are people from a different demographic, and they're bringing a completely different thing to American poetry right now. And that whole thing is really changing. It's an exciting time. It's a time of great change. So we'll just have to see how that all works out. And I don't explicitly talk about this in this book, but I'm trying to lay the groundwork for a way of approaching poetry that would work for anyone's poems and wouldn't just work for that academic classroom type poetry. I want to give reading back to people outside of the priesthood of academia.
Talking about reading and about priesthood, and we're coming to the end, I want to ask you about one aspect that has always impressed me and that I cherish, but I didn't quite understand at the beginning. And that is that poetry makes things slower. I find that when I read poetry, I read in a slower pace, with a slower rhythm, than when I read an essay or a short story or a novel, that poetry makes me pay more attention to even the spaces in between words or between sentences, or how a word might or might not sound. At a time when speed is celebrated, cherished, this slowness, I find it very important. So I wonder if you could tell me about your career, not as a poet, not as an essayist, but as a reader of poetry, and how that has changed.
I love that you asked this question. I have always been a very fast reader to a fault, and I'm always rushing through. I'm a very impatient, jumpy person. I'm actually not a naturally meditative or quiet type of soul. And so I think I'm both drawn to poetry and also feel it's very difficult for me sometimes to read poems. I have this physical urge to get up or speed through it. And I've come to see that for me, poems are an essential machine to get me to slow down. And it's taken me a long time. I've had to learn and to be fine with maybe reading one or two poems for an hour, you know, and just rereading them and dreaming and looking up in the sky and coming back to them or whatever. And it's not about reading all the poems by Wallace Stevens. It's about reading one or two of them maybe, but living with them for a long, long, long time, and that's okay. And this makes me think of something else, which is that a question that people have as well, you know, in this modern, postmodern age, whatever, with all this technology, whatever, how will poetry survive or how's it going to change? And I always think poetry is the thing that is going to protect us against being totally overrun by all this machinery and all this consciousness. All I have to do if I need to escape that stuff is shut off my computer and pick up a book of poems, and then immediately I'm changed by it. It's there waiting for me, and it requires hardly any money at all. It's unmonetized attention. It's not a monetary space. You know, I mean, they've managed, I mean, I'm going to sound like a crazy person here, but they've managed to monetize everything. Friendship, our free time, water, you know, drip bottled water. I mean, pretty soon it's going to be air, right? That's like the last thing. If somehow they'll manage to sell us that back too. But the one thing they can't do is they can't take away that piece of reading a book. They just can't figure that out yet. So like, it's old fashioned, but I still believe in that, and I need that for myself.
Circling back to Marianne Moore and to her unease in connection with poetry and to the beautiful way that she used the word fiddling and the genuine, it is probably a leitmotif in the history of literature that Plato, one of the greatest minds, together with Aristotle, maybe the two big thinkers after whom everything else is just chatter, exiled poets from his vision of what the Republic should be. In more recent times, we have had governments that have tried to cut funding for the National Endowment for the Arts and National Endowment for the Humanities, in a way de facto limiting the spread of poetry and other forms of literature. But in connection to the fiddling and in connection with the genuine and with Akhmatova and with Neruda, being opposed has not been bad for poetry. Having been exiled from that republic, being outside, can censorship be good in any way?
Well, Plato was probably right to exile the poets. They are troublemakers. If you want to have the perfect society where nobody makes any trouble, you know, you're going to want to get rid of the poets and the underground man and everybody plays music in their basement. You know, you're going to want to control all that. I mean, the wise dictators, if that's not a contradiction in terms, the clever ones know how dangerous poets are. Stalin knew full well.
Right.
Mao knew full well. And the most violent sociopathic of them understand what a threat it is to have just unmonetized, uncontrollable private thinking. I mean, Akhmatova wrote her poems. She didn't even write them down. They lived in the memories of her friends, but still they survived. Whether censorship can be good, I wouldn't wish that on anyone. That's not a problem that we have to deal with really in America. I mean, maybe there are isolated instances, but mostly I think you can pretty much say and publish what you want one way or the other. Maybe I'm missing something, but I think that feeling the opposing force and fighting it is necessary for poetry, and poets will find a way to do that. And I think poets are natural revolutionaries, and especially, you know, in these times, we really need free thinkers, not just poets, of course. I mean, and I think poets, whether it's literally censorship or just kind of like the force of silencing any kind of free thinking, I think poets are going to fight that till the end. They just are by their nature. But not just poets, but poets for sure.
Matthew Zapruder, it has been extraordinary to have you here, to hear your thoughts on poetry and to imagine a time when poetry is approached differently, for better or worse. Thank you for coming.
Oh, thanks. It's been such an honor and pleasure, really.
I disliked poetry when I was growing up. Or maybe I should put it in blunter terms. Poetry just didn't register for me. Many more things in the world caught my fancy. Movies, girls, outdoor activities. I remember with precision when this changed. It was rather late. I was already a teacher. Of literature, in fact. I still consistently ignored poetry. Perhaps because I thought it telegraphed its message rather than expand on it. And because it was cryptic. It fractured language in order to make itself clear. And it was elitist, for the very few. Then, a student of mine I loved asked me to speak at his wedding. He said he also wanted me to read a poem. He went even further. He had a specific poem in hand. Pablo Neruda's Your Laughter. I first told him it would be a pleasure, and then, almost as if it was supposed to be a chore, I looked for Neruda's poem. In my mind, that portion of the assignment was really the most mechanical. But Your Laughter transformed me. Forever. This is how it starts. Take breath away from me, if you wish. Take air away, but don't take away your laughter. Suddenly, the world seemed different. Can you really do this with words? Enchant, celebrate, reinvent, express passion in such direct, unadulterated form? The last two stanzas of the poem are astonishing. Here's how they sound in Donald D. Walsh's English translation. Next to the sea in autumn, your laughter must raise its foamy cascade, and in the spring, love, I want your laughter like the flower I was waiting for, the blue flower, the rose of my echoing country. Laugh at the night, at the day, at the moon. Laugh at the twisted streets of the island. Laugh at this clumsy boy who loves you. But when I open my eyes and close them, when my steps go, when my steps return, then I am bread, air, light, spring, but never your laughter, for I would die. From that occasion on, poetry for me is power. Poetry is beauty. Poetry is change. I am inevitably puzzled by the amphibious place poetry has in our culture, rejected by the majority, embraced by the few. I don't pretend that such equation should change. Poetry should always be a hidden secret. Those in on that secret, though, know something sublime. That words are never only words. Music is embedded in them, as are ideas, emotions, insights. In Being an Outcast, poetry plays the role of our caretaker. It waits for someone to discover it. And then, kaboom, magic is possible. Without poetry, we all would be far poorer, less empathetic. We would all be just a fraction of what we can be. Next time on In Contrast.
For me, one way to shape a story is to always be thinking about whose lives are going to be affected by this story and to think about what is responsible.
Next time on In Contrast, Hampshire Gazette editor Brooke Hauser. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Our intern is Delina Hadgood. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.